Memory Diving.
Yeah.
I love that title. Is that the title of the workshop then?
It was the title of the last one. I think that the next one is going to be slightly different because many of the people in the last one wanted to take the next one. And I thought, oh, well, I can't do the same thing over again if they're going to return. So I'm thinking Memory Diving was the first one, and I'm thinking the second one might be called Writing from the Threshold.
Both good titles. I like that as well. So Threshold seems to imply that you're not going into the room, you're on the threshold.
Yeah, I'm going to ask people to if it flies and if this is okay with the people at the good people at Kazoo Books, I'm going to ask people to think about standing at thresholds, literally or figuratively, in their lives. The beginning of something, the in-between, that interesting in-between period when you're on the threshold of something new.
Okay.
And to write from that, that's a spot of great energy.
Yeah.
Very dynamic energy. So I think they can get a lot of good writing from that.
It is great that you can offer a workshop like this, Gail. I mean,
it's
for,
fun.
What is it, 35 years that you were a professor
36.
At Kalamazoo? 36 yeah. mm-hmm. at Kalamazoo College. What did you teach over there?
I taught English literature, women's literature, creative writing, nonfiction writing, and women's studies.
And you've had quite a few books of your own, haven't you?
Three.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm, three.
And the most recent, I believe, is Events of October.
That's
which
right.
You could kind of say it was a memoir of your experience of it. But
yeah, part of it is.
So tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah. The Events of October is a study of the student murder-suicide we experienced at Kay College in 1999 when a young man lured his ex-girlfriend to his dorm room and where he had sequestered a shotgun and shot both of them, shot her and then shot himself. And it was certainly the most traumatic thing that happened at the college in my time there, maybe ever.
Yeah.
I don't know. And so I spent a couple of years researching that event and then a year writing up the story of mostly what happened to the campus.
Mm.
Not so much the families of the two students, but how the campus experienced that loss, that trauma.
So how is that different, delving into, deep diving into somebody else's memories and diaries and letters and texts and interviews, than doing your own story?
Yeah, harder, and it was fascinating because my first two books are mostly memoir. The first one is completely memoir and the second one is mostly. In some ways it was very different, and in one significant way it was the same. It's different in that you really have to be out of your own head a little bit and paying very close attention to the facts of the case and to other people's perspectives on what happened. And it's the same in that ultimately you're the one who has to make sense of it all.
Yeah.
You're the one who has to pull it all together. There really is no such thing as just an account of the facts. If there were, we could just publish the police report on the event.
True.
Which wouldn't make, it makes horrifying reading, but it does not make coherent, meaningful reading. For coherence and meaning, you have to rely on the author's perspective. So ultimately, it's my vision of what happened, but with a lot of attention paid to all of the facts I could gather and all of the perspectives I could gather from people who were there at the time.
Now, it would seem offhand that writing a memoir would be easy. Memoirs fascinate me.
It's going to be easy, and it never is.
Yeah, and why is that?
Some people think it's the hardest thing to write. I don't know. I'm very drawn to it. Always have been all my life, by the way.
Yeah.
Elementary school, I was writing memoirs into. Yeah, that's pretty scary.
Okay, so
What kind of memoir do you have when you're 7 years old? I don't know. You haven't lived that much. But I'm very drawn to it. People think it's going to be easy because it's what you know. It's your own life, for heaven's sakes. Just write it down. But in fact, to make a memoir meaningful takes a great deal more than just writing it down. Memory is a tricky thing. And what memory brings to you after you dive for it, to use the metaphor I used in the first workshop, after you bring it up from the bottom of the ocean and put it all out on the beach, it doesn't bring you a coherent story. You have to put it together somehow and explain to yourself what this means to you. So when I've taught memoir, I've always said to people, it's not the nature of what you remember, it's the way you treat what you remember, the way you frame it, the way you narrate it, the way you present it.
Yeah. And memoir we think of as something, well, nonfiction, that it should be fact. But as you just said, memory is very tricky.
It is.
I've sat down and talked with my sister about our childhood, and we were in the same house, same parents.
And you never know it, right?
Right. It sounds like we had two entirely different, removed from each other lives. And yet you can't say that it was our truth for each of us.
Right.
How do you deal with memories? Is there a trick to accessing them, for one thing? And then when you bring them up, how do you figure out what's accurate and what's not?
I think that your obligation is to your own truth. But I do think it's really important to check your truth against other people. For instance, if you were going to write something from your childhood, you might want to check it against what your sister remembers and allow her perspective to correct you a little bit without abandoning your own truth. If you remember a particular uncle as being really mean and she doesn't, you're entitled to present him as really mean. You can even include in the memoir, "My sister doesn't remember it this way."
Yeah.
A lot of the best memoirs actually talk about themselves as memoirs, talk about memory and the unreliability of memory and the subjectivity of all of what we're doing. Yeah. So you present it in a way that you offer a little bit of corrective.
And just for the record, I have nice uncles.
I'm glad to hear that.
One of your tactics that when I read about your workshops was to begin with simple sense memories.
Yeah.
Explain that.
That's fun. I make a list beforehand and I almost always abandon it on the day and do something different. But a list of words like warm, red, fear, pride, hard, sweet, excited, and read those out and give people a minute, let's say, to just jot down everything that word brings up for them. And most of them are sense memories. Some of them are emotional memories. And those tend to be pretty basic and pretty live. And often people will remember things they didn't know they remembered. They didn't remember that they remembered that.
Yeah.
They'll remember a red jacket they forgot they had or a teacher that they hadn't thought of in years. And then what I did this time in the workshop in June was to ask people to go over that list and select something that was particularly, I call it buzzing with energy, something that seems really promising, and write for about 15 minutes about that and see what comes out.
And then one of the hardest things, I think, in dealing with writing a memoir is offending people that you really care about.
Oh, yeah. It's a big one.
You know, when you tell your truth, whatever it might be, you might step on mom's toes.
You might.
You know, how do you cope with that?
Yeah, I have coped with that, actually. I did step on mom's toes. I wrote something about my deceased father that she didn't want me to put into my second book. And it's not that she was defending my deceased father. They were very unhappy together. And she knew that I knew he was not a nice guy. But there was something about respect for the dead and what would his grandchildren think. And so I included the story, but I didn't make it about my father. I said a relative instead of my father, and she was okay with that.
Okay, so we do have the license to disguise people
yes.
a little bit
and
to protect the guilty.
He was a relative, so yeah. I felt like I was telling the truth.
Yeah, that's true.
We talked about this in the June workshop a lot. There's a woman in the workshop who is a pastor who is trying to begin a memoir about her pastoral work with people in her congregation, and of course that's very private. That's like writing about your patients as a psychiatrist or a doctor. And I talked about the prevailing rules of nonfiction, which say you can disguise people, you can fuse characters, fuse two people into one person, you can give them different names, change their stories a little bit. All you have to do is acknowledge that you've done that and say somewhere at the beginning or the end of the book, some names and circumstances have been changed to protect privacy. The other thing to do is to get people to sign off and say, yes, you can use my story. And sometimes they're happy to do that. When in Events of October, my publisher, of course, required me to get legal permissions from absolutely everybody I interviewed. I did that, and I had a stack of paper. Yeah, so those are two ways to do it, the direct approach and the indirect approach, I guess.
Yeah.
I still had to change some names in the book, by the way.
So the other part of writing a memoir, I think, other than stepping on people's toes, would be an extreme vulnerability. And I imagine that even if you think you know your story, in the process of writing, do you discover that there's actually another story?
You do. And sometimes that other story lies underneath your own emotion about it. I remember when I was writing the chapter in The Events of October that is about me, that was about the role that I played in the follow-up to that disaster at Kalamazoo College. And I got very emotional writing it, and I had a lot of trouble writing it, and I was not having trouble writing that book. That book just came very fluidly to me. And I realized there was a whole other story going on of my own feelings about the role that I played, and was it legitimate, and the things that were said about me at the time by college officials, and how much that upset me, and obviously still did, because I was getting upset about it 7 years later,
yeah,
8 years later. So I thought, how much of that story is part of the bigger story, or should I just leave that out? I wrestled with that for weeks and weeks.
And avoiding making yourself a hero, I wonder, is that something where people want to present only their good side? Do you teach anything on that?
Yeah. You know, I think if you structure the writing assignment the right way, people will not write about the best day in their lives when they were the savior. They will write about the vulnerable days when they were lost or angry or hurt. That's where the real meanings lie. And I've been asked by students, why do we always have to write about what's miserable? And I always say, it's not that you can't write good memoir about happy experience. It's just that the happy experiences don't demand as much of us, and they don't ask to be clarified. And it's the difficult experiences that want writing about, because writing about them is our way to make sense of them for ourselves. A happy day out on the sailboat, I don't think needs much interpretation, although it can be a beautiful part of a memoir.
Yeah.
But the really difficult thing is the day your mother died.
So there's got to be an aspect of writing memoirs that is healing, that is writing as therapy?
Yeah, if you understand the word therapy, I'm imagining that there may be listeners who think therapy is about dumping your emotions on the table, and that doesn't make either good therapy or good writing. If therapy is talking your way through to a new kind of truth, then sure, yeah, there is a therapeutic aspect.
Although I imagine that when you begin, it might actually be, or at least feel the opposite of that,
You
really have to rip things open and maybe go into dark places that you'd rather not go.
Absolutely. I'm doing that now, and half the time I'm convinced that this is not worth writing about because it's so painful, and the other half of the time I'm thinking maybe that's why you need to write about it.
Do you find that your readers respond to those places the most?
Oh, much more than anything else, yes. Yeah.
Yeah, I think most readers have little antenna that go up. If you're holding back, I think people can tell.
They do. If you don't give them anything that really costs you something to give, they know they haven't received anything.
Yeah.
And I was first drawn to memoir because I'm fascinated by other people's lives. I mean, we think we know each other, but we walk around pretty much enclosed in the cases of our own little realities. And memoir kind of crashes through that and allows you into somebody's life, usually at a time when you really get to know someone well, if it's a good memoirist who's being honest about her or his experience.
So when is the right time? Probably not when you were 7 years old.
But, no.
So when are you at the point, you know, does it necessarily have to be the end of life or?
When it keeps knocking at your door, when it keeps scratching at your ear and saying, listen to me, write about this. People generally know because they have a feeling they ought to be writing about something. And I think teenagers can write memoir. I think little kids can write memoir. I think I was right to, you know, what happened to me yesterday when I was 7 is a memoir. You know, going to camp when I was 10, I couldn't write about it then because I didn't know how huge it was going to be. But in my second book, I finally took it on and wrote about how important that was to me. But I think all the way along, we are writing our own experience is a fundamental human need. Making sense of our own experience. Some people do it through writing. I have a friend who does it through dance. You know, people have their different ways of doing it.
I read somewhere that there was a study on how memory works, and that, which surprised me, that every time you call back a memory, you actually corrupt it.
Yes.
And rather than thinking that every time, you know, if you're thinking about something a lot, that you're actually mm-hmm. firming up that memory, it's actually the opposite.
Supposedly, what we remember is the previous memory of what we remember.
Or I imagine we bring the perspective of who we are today.
Yes.
Like if you're remembering that 7-year-old, you're mm-hmm. remembering her as an experienced, mature woman.
Right.
And that's a different person.
Exactly.
You're living in a different life today.
In fact, there's a friend of mine, Sue William Silverman, who has several extraordinary memoirs, has asked if she has a textbook a textbook about writing memoir, and she says that one of the things you have to keep your eye on is that there are two different selves in a memoir. There's the person doing this stuff, and then there's the person remembering it. And the distance between those two is very, very important. And you ask yourself, do I want to tell this story completely from the perspective of that other person, or do I want to add the perspective I'm bringing now as an older person who knows more, hopefully?
Yeah.
And that's an interesting thing. That's one of the complicated things to handle.
I think it may actually be the same book where I read something about where Silverman quoted you, and some people think of memoirs as navel-gazing or narcissistic, but you're saying that's not so.
I absolutely do not believe that that is so. And memoir comes in for so much attack in the past 20 years. We're living in a major renaissance of the genre, first of all. There's never been an era in the Western world when memoir has proliferated the way it has in the past 10 or 20 years. And the backlash is huge. And memoir is accused of being an indicator of the narcissism of our society, and how we're all a nation of victims, and we're all into our own victimization, et cetera, et cetera. And I think that the difference is between good memoir and bad memoir. Good memoir never has that result, in my experience. It's always about connecting the self to the world around it. And it's always about struggle and ultimate achievement of some sort, not necessarily conquering whatever the obstacle is, but achieving some kind of clarity or freedom or insight or something. So the memoir that just gazes at its own navel is not going to be very fun to read. And there's a lot of just beautiful, wonderful memoirs out there.
So I wonder, this upswing of memoirs that you're referring to over the last 20 years, mm-hmm. maybe rather than navel-gazing, it is isolation, that people maybe are mm-hmm. more disconnected, and it's kind of like almost like social media, mm-hmm. an attempt to connect with others.
I think that might very well be true. I also think that gender has something to do with this whole discussion, in that a lot of this renaissance of memoir was generated by women writers. And I think that's part of the reason it's come under attack. Whatever writing women decide to do will be attacked. It happened when women were writing the novel in the 18th century too. Yeah. So, and I think one reason that women came to memoir is that their lives were not being told. Their stories were not present. So it was an effort to say, here I am. Here's what it's actually like to grow up as a girl or to suffer sexual assault or whatever, as opposed to the versions that you find in popular media that are not guided by women's own experience.
You've also said that it's healthy to look inward first, outward after.
Mm-hmm.
Can you elaborate on that?
Sue asked me to write that, by the way, because she was writing an article confronting some of the critics of memoir who had said terrible things about her and her work. And so I chimed in and gave her my 2 cents. Okay, so look inward first and then outward. I think it's a constant, I'm forgetting what I said there, but I think it's a constant process of back and forth, inward, outward, inward, outward, outward, inward. I think we always do that. as human beings. And when we're writing memoir, we're never just looking inward. We're always looking around us. Our lives are not self-enclosed. That's the marvelous thing about memoir. Our lives overlap other people's lives every moment of the day. So we're always looking around us and then looking within. And the self, if you want to call it that, I think is an accumulation of outward and inward energies. And I think memoir is a way to sort all that out, or try to.
You're also known in our community for wonderful seminars, lectures, talks, workshops.
Thank you.
On white privilege, on gender issues, mm-hmm. women's rights, those type of things. How does that, I imagine it overlaps with memoir, if, say white privilege.
Mm-hmm.
If you're white and you read a good memoir by someone of a different race than you are.
That is, in fact, one of the primary ways in which I educated myself about race and racism in this country. It was reading memoir. The first one was by a white man who chemically altered the color of his skin and went through the Jim Crow South as a black man and found out what it was like. It was called Black Like Me by John Howard Griffin, no relation. And I read it in high school, and I was fascinated. But subsequently, I read memoirs by African Americans, by Native Americans, by Latinos and Latinas, and it was my way of crossing over and imagining what someone else's reality was like, and therefore being able to see that my reality is circumscribed by whiteness. It's not just a human reality, it's a white reality. And so I have been writing about that for about the past 10 years.
Is that what you're working on right now? Tell us what you're working on. Is it a memoir?
Or I have just finished an essay about what we used to call a colored baby doll that I had in the 1950s. In the Detroit suburbs. And I've been trying to write about her for several years now, and I think I finally got it right. And I completed a piece about her a couple months ago that I'm now shopping around. It's getting a lot of rejections, unfortunately, but it'll find its place.
Uncomfortable material often.
Well, maybe. I don't know. But I remembered her, and then I remembered her name. It was Gloria. I named her Gloria. I thought that was the most beautiful name in the world. And I remembered that my mother gave her to me, and then I remembered that my mother made me give her away. And so there was this giant question mark. And my mother is gone now. I can't ask her to figure that out for me. My brother doesn't have any memory of this doll. So I just began to analyze what it meant for a white girl in the suburbs of Detroit to have a black baby doll it must have been 1955 or 56. And why would it have been given to me, and why would I have been asked then to give it up? And I think that just reaches into all of the racial complications of that era, especially in the Detroit era, which is profoundly defined by race issues. So I did a little bit of history of Detroit interwoven with my own history and tried to figure all that out.
So the 7-year-old does have a memoir.
Yeah. Well, she didn't then. She wouldn't have known. She just would have said, shoot, I had to give up my doll. But the 65-year-old is really interested in that.
Yeah. There's those two selves you were talking about.
Yeah. Exactly.
Are there memoirs that are especially close to your heart that you read or that you would recommend for others to read?
Well, I was going to say in my ongoing education on race and racism, Maya Angelou's first book was a classic for me, and I think it is a classic of American autobiography. I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings. It's so simply and straightforwardly told, and so profound on so many levels. It's episodic. It's not particularly chronological. Each chapter is a particular episode in her girlhood. It deals centrally with gender as well as race, and I just love it. Sue Silverman's first book, Because I Remember Terror, Father, I Remember You, which is a memoir of a terrible incestuous abuse that she suffered as a child, is paradoxically one of the most beautiful things I've ever read. It's just It's just stunningly well written, and I taught it over and over and over again at Kalamazoo College, devastating generations of students along the way. There's a million of them. I just finished H is for Hawk by Helen Alexander, or Helen Anderson is her name, I'm sorry. She's a British woman who lost her father very suddenly. She was very close to her father, and she works through her grief by training a goshawk, which is a very difficult thing to do. And the bird becomes this monumental character in her life. And it was fascinating.
So tell us a little more about the workshop that's coming up September 12th.
September 12th, I'm doing another workshop at Kazoo Books out on Parkview. Those wonderful, wonderful people out there who support independent booksellers and authors in town. And I'm going to call it, I think, Writing from the Threshold, and ask people to imagine threshold moments in their lives, literal thresholds. Imagine yourself standing in a doorway and then tell me what the doorway is and what you're about to enter. Or metaphorical thresholds. What was a time in your life when you felt that you were on the verge of something? That's often a moment that's charged with great energy. So whether you're entering a new job or a marriage or a relationship or school, or whether you're just entering a new phase of yourself, can mean a lot. I remember a lot of doorways from my childhood. The doorway to my kindergarten, for instance, is very vitally alive in my mind. And the entrance to school becomes really symbolic for me because I spent my whole life in school until
yes,
2 years ago. My whole life has been in school. So I think we can get a lot of productive stuff out of the idea of the threshold.
And in your first workshop at Kazoo Books, what kind of people, different ages or
yes,
who did you see?
They were mostly people middle age and older. I put a requirement that everybody had to be at least 20, because I think teaching memoir writing to kids is a different kind of workshop. There were about 14 of them. They were absolutely lovely. All but one were female, which doesn't surprise me. I'm not sure I can explain it, but it doesn't surprise me. Three or four people that I knew from different worlds in my life. And we just had a whale of a time. We had a wonderful time for 3 hours. For the first hour and a half or 2 hours, we did exercises to generate material. And then the last hour, they wrote for a while and then exchanged what they wrote and read them aloud. And then we spent about 15 minutes just talking about issues in nonfiction writing that they wanted to raise.
And have you something there that you can read to us?
I do. I mentioned my father before. I never write about him because he was dying of cancer by the time I was 6 or 7. He was never home. He was always in the hospital. And when he was home, he was unpleasant. I have more sympathy for him now than I did then. But I was not devastated by his death. Let me just put it that way. And lately, pieces have come out about my dad. So I wrote them down, and one of them is called Basement, and it comes from the geography of the 1950s, where very often the main floor of the house belonged to the woman. She decorated it like crazy and cooked and entertained and had her bridge club, and the basement was the man cave. The basement was redone to sort of reflect a man's sensibility. It is what we now would call a man cave. Paneled, dark, woody, green, dark green colors. And that's what our basement was about. So I decided to walk back through the basement and try to get at the world my father lived in, the world of masculinity. So this is called Basement, and it's just a paragraph long. Close the door behind you and go down the stairs. This is my father's world as you sing in church, down here below the women and their talk. His friends herd with him here, the ones called Uncle this or that. There's a big round table covered in green felt. At its center sits a carousel shaped like a cake. Tuck the stack of waxy blue bicycle cards in the angled slot on top. Crank it like a jack-in-the-box. Watch the cards spit out neatly into 6 bays around the base. Next to the table is a paneled bar where stands a little naked boy of silver metal. Stick him on a bottle, and pea-colored Canadian club streams from the end of the fat silver penis he holds thoughtfully in his hands. There are two doors. One leads to the furnace room, huddled there next to the big pipes and vents on summer afternoons till the tornado warning has passed. The second door is locked. No one goes in without him. This is his workroom, where the power tools live. Just inside the door, attached to the thick lip of a high table, is the vise. Crank another handle, and two dense iron bricks slowly close upon each other to hold things still so he can saw them up. Put your left hand inside and turn the handle with your right. As the big jaws come together, feel the cold metal, then a push, then the squeeze. One more crank, one more. Imagine your hand spreading like pie dough. Imagine your whole body flattening like clay under this pressure.
Thank you, Gail.
Thank you.